Welcome to Under Lock and Key, news and commentary about prisons from the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League.
An organization of Pennsylvania prisoners calls for a phone boycott in May.
California's three strikes law is not linked to a drop in crime.
A new film documents the central role of prisons in rural towns.
Mamiya Abu-Jamal asks, is the death penalty the poor's prerogative?
Massachusetts Supreme Court is weighing prisoner DNA databank.
The U.S. incarcerates a greater percentage of its population than any other country, sending more black men to prison than to college. The purpose of this program is to educate about and inspire activism against the American lockdown.
An organization of Pennsylvania prisoners and their families is protesting the high surcharges of prisoners collect phone calls. They are calling for prisoners to boycott the phone system for the month of May. In recent years, many state prisons have instituted new phone systems, which often place restrictions on who prisoners can call and require that calls be made collect. Worse still is that the surcharge for collect calls from prison is much higher than on regular collect calls, with the Department of Corrections benefiting from this extortion. In the hopes of forcing the Department of Corrections to negotiate the contract with AT&T, Voices Behind the Walls is asking prisoners to boycott the 1,300 phones in the state's prison during the month of May.
Rail insists that the restriction on prisoners' phone calls shows that the U.S. justice system is not concerned about crime. One of the few things that affects recidivism is the amount of contact a prisoner has with their family, and by the high phone fees, the system wants to cut prisoner and family communication. Prisoners come from the poorest families who already pay taxes to support the prison system. But on top of that, the state wants to tax these families again through the phone charges. Since the installation of new phone systems, we have learned of a number of boycotts organized by prisoners. The planning of this effort speaks well to the boycott's potential of success. The prisoners' actions may have an even greater impact by disrupting an already existing income stream for the Department of Correction. Data on California's crime rate and draconian three strikes legislation shows that there is no connection between crime and imprisonment rates.
Under California's three strikes law, any person convicted of a third felony may receive a sentence of 25 years to life. This has led to such injustices as a man being sentenced to 25 years for stealing a piece of pizza, another for stealing a pair of blue jeans, yet another for stealing a bottle of aspirin, and on and on. Whether or not to try a particular felony as a third strike is up to the discretion of the prosecutor. The rate of third strike convictions in Sacramento is 12 times that of San Francisco. However, the crime rate in San Francisco dropped more in San Francisco than any other city in California. As we discussed in a previous program, the drop in crime rates across the U.S. is likely due to the temporary upturn in the economy and perhaps a decrease in the trade in crack cocaine. California, Uber Alice. California, Uber Alice. California, Uber Alice. California, Uber Alice.
I'm so proud to know the great communicator. Wanna be known as the great incarcerator. I'll blow environmentalists away, and I'll be the Führer someday. I keep cutting public education, even though we rank 45th in the nation. I got a plan for the minorities. I send them to the California Youth Authority. From San Francisco Urban Elementary to Pelican Bay State Penitentiary. There they can work for the master race and always wear a happy face. Close your eyes, it can't happen here. Big brother and his squad car's coming near. Come and join the surf and sun and keep California number one.
Yes, in My Backyard is a new film by Tracy Euling.
This film is a valuable resource for anti-prisons activism because it describes the extent to which prisons have become an asset to the U.S. economy. The film's strength is in showing the extent to which the prison industry encourages its employees, their dependents, and players in regional economies to think of prisons only as an economic boon. People whose families' bills have always been paid by the prisons have no incentive to question the rehabilitative value of the prisons or to ask if increased imprisonment has any effect at all on the crime rate for which it was supposed to answer. Yes, in My Backyard is about Coxsackie, a small Hudson River community in New York whose local economy is based on two state prisons. Describing the character of Coxsackie and towns like it, The filmmaker said part of the reason she wanted to make this film is that the prisons are central to the town's existence. In these towns, everybody knows people who work there, and most families depend on the prison for their livelihood. But nobody will talk about what this means in public. The major difference is that 20 or 30 years ago, there were not really as many prison towns in this country. And half a century ago, prisons were not a central growth industry in the United States. America's status as an imperialist country gives its citizens the luxury to work in non-productive jobs. But the 1970s brought the beginnings of a boom in prisons, and with it tremendous growth in the number of people directly employed in the business of military control of the oppressed nations. A retired corrections officer interviewed in the film explains the job security prisons provide.
Before I even started a job, they was always telling me, the worst things get out in the world, the better things get in jail. You'll always have a job.
Prisoners at Green are shown doing farm work in Yes in My Backyard. The prison has a milk and dairy farm run by a local farmer. In one unnarrated scene, an unseen guard yelled at a black prisoner working in the dairy farm to pull his pants up. The same scene was repeated without the yelling one or two more times during the film. Our best guess is that this scene was evidence of the general harassment of the oppressed nationalities that goes on in the prisons. In Michigan, where Rail saw this film, wearing saggy pants and other black urban styles is classified as the mark of a gang or security threat group member. We assume the white rural guards in New York are as intolerant and repressive of black culture as the white rural guards in Michigan. Coxsackie opened its first prison early to replace the town's dwindling commercial economy. A local historian explains in the film that as a river town, Coxsackie saw a lot of commerce from the Hudson River traffic 100 years ago. But once the highway was built and goods transportation switched to road vehicles, the town needed some new enterprise. Coxsackie is happy with its two prisons and wants another one built in their community. The mayor, who is also a prison employee, explains why he supports building more prisons in his town.
I'm advocating right now another prison, or at least additions to the existing prisons, to whoever I talk to about it, because the more beds we have over there, the more inmate population, the more water they're going to use, and the more of our sewer services they're going to use, and the more jobs are going to be needed. You politic for it. That's what you do.
As a long-term prison town, Coxsackie has a lot of history and the social issues and problems that run through many prison towns. The vast majority of women in the town's domestic violence shelter are correctional officers' wives and girlfriends. A domestic violence official in Albany is quoted in the film saying that the level of danger of domestic violence in corrections and criminal justice families is markedly high. This is not only because corrections and police officers are more likely to be violent, but because they are trained in methods of physical force that do not leave visible wounds. The fact of domestic violence in correction officers' families underscores the sick nature of imprisonment in this country. Prisons are supposed to be places of rehabilitation. Corrections employees should live by higher standards of patience, self-awareness, and responsibility for others than people in other professions. Yet they are trained to inspire terror in prisoners and in their own families.
To Rail, this illustrates the fact that U.S. prisons will not be reformed to the point of being genuine institutions of correction and rehabilitation. While it is true that some people who are in prisons today have committed crimes by proletarian standards, this does not mean that they should be subjected to abuse and torture. Those who carry out the abuse have committed far greater crimes, and so are in no position to exact any form of justice. Rail is happy to see people like Tracy Euling making honest films about prisons and their proponents. Working as anti-imperialists from the vantage point of the people who are oppressed under imperialism, Rail sees that building more prisons is in the interest of many people in this country. Employing people to work in the prisons, paying money to towns for service to the prison, these are methods of bribing Americans to support prisons and other forms of imperialism. There is broad support in this country for greater imprisonment because the majority benefit from it. Yes in My Backyard documents this support in government and in the eyes of corrections employees and their community. Stay tuned to the end of this program for information on how to contact the filmmaker and to order the film.
That's what capital punishment really means. Those that ain't got the capital gets the punishment, is the old saying. Once again, we see the inherent truths that lie in the Proverbs of the Poor. That old saying echoed when it was announced that the District Attorney of Delaware County, Patrick Meehan, would not seek the death penalty in the case of John E. DuPont, the wealthy corporate heir charged with the shooting death of Olympic champion David Schultz. The Delaware County DA's office said no aggravated circumstances justifying the death sentence existed. Could it be that DuPont's personal wealth, estimated at over $400 million, was a factor? In one fell swoop, the state ensured that while millionaires may be murderers, they are not eligible for that preserve of the poor, America's death row. As the case of O.J. Simpson showed us, the state is very selective in who it chooses to include in its macabre club of death. O.J., a bona fide celebrity, corporate pitchman, sports legend, and millionaire, was deemed, even though a suspect in a double murder, not fit for a death sentence. So, whether or not one is of the opinion that Mr. Simpson was either innocent or guilty, the point remains that before the trial actually began, the DA of Los Angeles decided no death penalty for O.J. Millionaires need not apply. As it was for Mr. Simpson, so it was for Mr. DuPont. Simpson's wealth compared to DuPont's makes him look like a pauper. As for DuPont, consider, if you will, the incredible spectacle of the DA with all the identical facts announcing he or she would not be seeking the death penalty if DuPont was the victim. I'm sure we can all agree that would be impossible. Any poor man who slays a wealthy man will have the weight of the system fall on him like a ton of bricks. For a wealthy man, however, who finds himself charged with killing a poor man, the system becomes user-friendly. Why should this be so? It's because the system serves the interest of the wealthy. It is their system. In essence, when a poor person comes before the court, he or she faces two things, the offense and being poor. I am not suggesting that Mr. DuPont, or anyone else for that matter, should be sentenced to death. I'm just noting how and why the death sentence is reserved for some and off-limits to others. The death sentence remains a prerogative of the poor. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
In August, we reported that Superior Court Judge Isaac Borenstein had struck down the Massachusetts law requiring the pigs to create a database of prisoner DNA. With 2,500 samples already stolen from prisoners, a hearing was held on March 1st before the Supreme Judicial Court on the issue.
All 50 states have laws requiring the police to create DNA databanks for at least some types of prisoners. Not all states have yet implemented the laws, and the federal government has not yet started. The Massachusetts law was struck down in the name of privacy rights in the Fourth Amendment. Judge Borenstein argued in August that, regardless of the state's compelling interest, an unjustified random bodily intrusion without any indication of individualized suspicion is unreasonable and intolerable. Typically, privacy rights are reserved for those with power and prestige to protect. We emphasize the word rights because, unlike the bourgeoisie, we don't believe that there are certain rights that people have. Rather, we believe that there are no rights, only power struggles. The only thing that we can count on in this world is what the masses themselves can fight to gain and retain. The Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution claims to speak for all citizens, even though it is rarely that way in practice, but is a good tactic for progressive lawyers to try and get the Bill of Rights to apply to everyone, especially prisoners. The government argued that if the state can collect a criminal's fingerprints, why not their DNA? The suing prisoners responded that fingerprints are used for identification purposes, while here the government wants to take all prisoners' DNA without any individualized suspicion.
Yes in My Backyard was produced by Galloping Girls Productions, Incorporated. You can contact Galloping Girls at Rural Route No. 1, Box 168, Freehold, New York, 12431, and the telephone number is 518-634-2170.
This has been Under Lock and Key, a revolutionary anti-imperialist league program about prisons. For more information, contact RAIL, P.O. Box 712, Amherst, Massachusetts 01004, or email railradio@mim.org.